Hello, and thank you for joining me on my third show for my biweekly podcast. Why am I doing this, you might ask? Well, I simply have a desire to learn and evolve constantly and endlessly. All my friends and family know this. Next to love and peace, self-evolution is right there. To become my best self is of the utmost importance, and so these conversations basically help me to do that. Let's jump in. Today, our topic is The Secret is You. We're going to talk about the importance of perception, visualization, self-talk, which is a biggie for me, and developing a sense of humor, as well as the one and only Frank Sinatra. And I couldn't have a better guest joining me to explore all of this. I adore this man. And that's saying a lot because I adore few spirits. Tom Dreesen is my guest today. He is a comedian, motivational speaker, philanthropist, and best of all, he's my Uncle Tom. He has been a part of my family since before I was born, and he's simply my dad's brother, truly. But besides all of that, his life is equal parts comedy and philanthropy. He excels at both and has created an extraordinary legacy in both arenas. He's made over 500 appearances, 500 on national television as a stand-up comedian, including more than 60 appearances on The Tonight Show. He was actually a favorite guest of David Letterman's and frequently hosted the show in his absence. For 13 magical years, he toured cross-country and opened for the one and only Frank Sinatra. He's also appeared countless times with artists like Smokey Robinson, Liza Minnelli, Natalie Cole, and the great Sammy Davis Jr. He is currently appearing to rave reviews around the country in his one-man show, An Evening of Laughter and Memories of Sinatra. And it truly is. I had the pleasure of seeing it with my brother Tim, and it was definitely one of the best times I've ever had. He's genuine, funny as hell, salt of the earth, and I think what God was thinking when he created goodness. Tom Dreesen, a.k.a. my Uncle Tom, and I'll be calling you that throughout the show. Thank you for joining me today.
I think that introduction was longer than my career, and I'm humbled. And I'm humbled by it. Thank you so much.
That was long.
Now let's explain to your listeners why you call me Uncle Tom, because obviously, your dad and I were America's first black and white comedy team. I played the white guy.
Yes.
It was a stretch for me, but I was able to pull it off. But we were the first black and white comedy. We started in September 1969, so it was 50 years ago this September that Tim and I, your dad and I, went on stage for the first time. And we were America's first black and white comedy team, and history now shows that we are the last, that there's never been one after us. We wrote a book called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White, that we're hoping now that we're meeting with people about it either being a feature film or a series at Netflix. So that's where we're in the process now. And before you were born, when your little brother was born, and he was a little boy, I would go by the house, and of course I'd pick him up and I'd carry him and I'd swing him to my legs and swing him like, I'm going to throw you to the moon, we're going to go to the moon. And every time he'd see me, he'd say, let's go to the moon. So I'd have him call me Uncle Tommy. So, and then you followed suit when you were born the same way. So, and my favorite story about that is that when your dad and I were on a book tour trying to sell our book, we went to Norfolk
State
Norfolk College. State.
Yes.
Where your daddy went to school, a historical black college. And you hadn't seen me in about a year, and we were at a buffet. I was going to get something to eat with six black college professors, and you walked in the door about 100 feet away or 200 feet away or whatever, and you saw me, and you hollered across the room, Uncle Tom, Uncle Tom. And these professors turned around and looked at you, and I said to them, she's talking to me. She's talking to me. That's our story, you know. But anyhow, it's a delight to be on your show, and let's talk. What do you want to talk about? We'll talk about anything you want to talk about.
Nice. I appreciate that. Let's talk magic. First off, I'm, as you know, crushed that I didn't get to meet Frank Sinatra. I remember you telling me so casually, you said, oh, Tori, if I would have known you were a huge Sinatra fan, you could have met him. You could have been on the private plane with us and gone to Vegas and seen him perform. And it's just devastating every time I think about that. I know that was a magical experience for you. How was all of that for you?
It's hard to describe that rarefied air, and especially, you know, knowing where I came from. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, a suburb called Harvey, Illinois. I had eight brothers and sisters. We lived in a shack, literally a shack. We had no bathtub, no shower, no hot water. It was a rat-infested, roach-infested shack. And I had holes in my shoes as big around as a coffee cup my whole childhood. I shined shoes in taverns. I set pins in bowling alleys. I caddied in the summertime. I sold newspapers on the corner to help feed my brothers and sisters. Now, flash forward, I'm shining shoes in the bars, and Sinatra's on all the jukebox, Frank Sinatra, singing on the jukeboxes. And I'm on my hands and knees in these smelly, smoky bars, shining shoes. And that's when I first heard Frank Sinatra, when I was like 8 years old, on these jukeboxes. Mm-hmm. And then years later, when I was out of the service and I would be tending bar, trying to find my way through life, what I was going to do, I'd be tending bar in the taverns, and on the jukebox, Frank would be singing, "Come fly with me, let's fly away." And here I was flying.
Wow.
In his private jet all over the world. I was staying in his home six, seven times a year in this rarefied air, you know, not only in the private jets, but squad cars and limousines rushing us to the jet to catch a jet. Then from there, landing in some city and squad cars and limousines rushing us to the arena. And we'd do the show. And after my show, he would come out, and then he would get to center stage and call me back out. "Tommy, come back out and take another bow. Tommy Dreesen, ladies and gentlemen, and my man Tommy," and all that kind of stuff. Here I was gracing the same stage with this living legend, and him allowing me to do that. So I was in an air that I had to pinch myself. I would stay at his home. And he would, at his home would be Gregory Peck and his wife Veronique, and Sidney Poitier and his wife Joanne, and Kirk Douglas and his wife Anne, Jack Lemmon and his wife Felicia, you know, Sammy Davis, of course, and Alta Viz, and, you know, Dean Martin, Clint Eastwood, and Quincy Jones. These are people I saw in film for years in Harvey when I was a little boy. And now I'm mingling with them and not letting them know how much in awe of I am of this whole circumstance because of where I came from. So it was just hard to believe that this was happening to me, and I never let Frank know how much in awe of him I was, because I picked up on that when I first met him. I felt that he had enough fans. He didn't need another fan. He wanted a pal, a buddy. And at first, he was the boss on the tour, and what a great boss he was. And he paid me well and took good care of me. And then as years went by, we became friends, like buddies. And toward the end of his life, he came more like a father to me and gave me a lot of advice and things like that. You know, a lot of lessons he taught me.
Now, you told me once, and I know you remember this, something he said. I think it was all of you, the group that you said, Gregory Peck, who I actually had the pleasure of meeting. He is a lovely man at the Golden Globes. But you said you sat with Gregory Peck, you were sitting with Sammy Davis, all these people, and you told me something about someone asking something about blessings, or how do you feel blessed? Do you remember that? I don't remember how you said it, but I know he said friends. The answer was friends.
Well,
you told me you
were
sitting around.
What happened was, it was on his 82nd birthday, and he passed away 5 months later. And he had been ill for a while, and we were all over at his house, having dinner at his house, and waiting for the cake to come out. Dinner was over, and it was Gregory Peck and his wife Veronique, and it was Kirk Douglas and his wife Anne, and all these celebrities, Jack Lemmon, and we were making small talk, waiting for the cake to come out, and Frank was over in the corner. You know, we didn't know whether he was with us sometimes or he was not. He would be there, and then he just seemed like he'd fade. And he was actually trying to eat. The woman that used to take care of him was a black woman named Vine that was with him for like 40 years. And he adored her. She was just took care of him all the time. And she was helping him eat. And so we were making small talk, thinking he wasn't quite with us, waiting for the cake to come. Somebody said, "Where is the best place to live?" And Gregory Peck said, "Well, Veronique and I have a villa in France, and we like it there." And Robert Wagner and Jill St. John said, "Oh, we have a place in Aspen, and we like it there." And Frank, with his head down over in a corner, said, "The best place to live is where your friends are." And the whole room went, oh, because, you know, here's a man, my point of this story is, here's a man arguably the greatest career show business has ever known. I mean, forget about the fact of what the greatest pop singer of all time. What an actor. He won the Academy Award, never took an acting lesson.
That's right.
He won the Academy Award in From Here to Eternity. And he danced with Gene Kelly, for God's sake. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This was the greatest career. 60 years he was a star. He sold out in Japan in when he was 78 years old. He sold out in Argentina. He sold out in Moscow. He holds a single record drawing 175,000 people in Brazil. 175,000. No single performer has ever done that. Rock groups may have done it, but no single performer. But after at this point in his life, all of that being said, Grammys, Oscars, you know, in the end, it wasn't about any of those things. It was about friends. It was about relationships. That's the last lesson he taught me, and he taught me so many lessons. You know, he was.
I was going to ask you that. Can you?
Well,
you're
going to
share with me
a lesson. One of the things about our profession, I love live performing. That's what I am, a stand-up comedian, first, last, and always. Have I acted? Yeah, I've done film, and I'm an actor, but my love is stand-up comedy and live performing. And there was no one better at that than Sammy Davis Jr. and Frank Sinatra and people like that. They were truly the best of live performers. But he always taught me, I don't care what you do all night long, showtime. You show up on time, prepared, ready for the show. You know, punctuality, always respect for time. He told me so many times, Tommy, if you have a meeting with someone and they tell you to be there at 9 o'clock and you show up at 9:15, you just said that your time was more important than theirs. You have no respect for their time. You know, and so showtime was important. Know your job, know what you're supposed to do, and let's turn it on for the audience. I once said to him, why do we wear tuxedos? He said, Tommy, if we were going to do a show for the king and the queen, royalty, would we wear a tuxedo? I said, well, I'm sure we would. He said, okay. Well, that garage mechanic in Detroit who's struggling to make ends meet and his wife who's a waitress, that maybe they can afford two tickets for one performance a year. When they come, they're just as important as a king and a queen, so we wear tuxedos for them. Every night is a command performance. And you know, and that's what he was all about. And I'll share one more story with you that where he taught me another lesson. We were coming out of the Waldorf Astoria one night. We were on our way to do a show, and we went out the back entrance. He had a big suite at the Waldorf Astoria, an apartment, and we got the back way because he'd be mobbed if he went out the front. And we're rushing to the limousine to go to this engagement that we're going to do. And as we were rushing to the limousine, a woman jumped out of the doorway, and the bellman told me that she had been there for 5 hours waiting. She jumped out of the doorway, and she started screaming, Mr. Sinatra, please, Mr. Sinatra, please, please. And we were getting in the limo, and finally she was hollering, please, Mr. Sinatra. And he stopped, and he turned around, and he said, what is it? And the security was holding her back. He walked up to her, and said, what is it? She said, my husband is homesick, and if I could get an autograph from you to him, it would mean the world to him. Would you please sign it? And he said, sure. And he's signing the autograph, and she said, what beautiful cufflinks. They were $2,000 cufflinks. I know where he got them at. He said, thank you. And when he finished the autograph, he took the cufflinks off, and he gave them to her. He said, give these to your husband. She said, no. I was just admiring them. I just admired them. I don't want them. He said, no, I want you to have them. Give them to your husband. Now, we get in the limousine, and I said, Frank, that was beautiful. But why did you do that? He said, Tommy, if you possess something that you can't give away, then you don't possess it. It possesses you. And I never forgot that. He said, it's okay if somebody says that they love your Mercedes-Benz and you don't give it to them. But when you're alone in the bathroom shaving, you got to admit to that guy in the mirror, that car owns you because you can't give it away. And he not only talked that talk, he walked that talk.
Yeah. What do you miss most about him?
That, you know, that we've developed this friendship toward the end where he was like a father to me. And also, Tori, I can't explain to you that everywhere you went, the energy that where he went, that went into a room. You know, Frank Sinatra could walk into an arena of 20,000 people and he hadn't sung a note. And he's walking to the microphone and that the eruption of the crowd. You know, his music for most of his fans was a soundtrack of their lives. people got married to his music, you know, they got engaged to his music. When somebody loves you, it's no good unless she loves you. You know, they got married to his music, love and marriage, love. You know, they got divorced to his music, and he sat in that bar alone, you know, longing for the woman, and, you know, it's 2:45, there's no one in the place except you and me. And they got remarried to his music, you know, love is lovelier the second time around. So his music was the soundtrack of their life. So to witness this kind of adoration from people from all walks of life, like you, who liked him, who liked his music. That's what I miss. I miss that kind of, every time we're going on the road, I can't tell you what that's like. I mean, you know, just flying all over the world in this private jet and crowds cheering, and it was really a lot of fun. And hanging out with him and the advice he'd give me, you know, it was I turned down more sitcoms than most comedians get offered in a lifetime in those years that I toured with Frank, because every time they would come to me to do a show with some ensemble group or something like that, and would I do it, it would mean I'd have to give up touring with him. And I just didn't want to do that. You know, I knew it was the end of
an
era.
And you don't regret it, I'm sure.
I don't. Because in the end, Tori, all we have are memories. In the end, that's all we have, our memories. And so make good ones.
Right.
Make real good ones.
You're right. You've been in Hollywood a long time. And after that experience with him, did you come to see it, Hollywood, the glitz and the glamour, differently? Because you were, you know, your circle was an elite, legendary circle. So did that change how you looked at Hollywood, how you maneuvered in Hollywood at all?
Yeah, I be honest with you, I was never really a Hollywood guy. You know, when I was touring with Frank, these were not the nouveau riche Hollywood. These were well established, the Pecks, the you know, Portiers, Kirk Douglas's. You know, they were established. And when you were at a cocktail party at Frank's house, or you're, you know, just house guests, they would ask you, tell me about stand up comedy. Now, how did you get interested in that, Tommy? They wouldn't talk about their careers and what fabulous careers they had. I would have to prod it out of them, you know, if I was to ask them a question. But so I never was a Hollywood kind of guy. But when I got with those folks, it seemed like it was so much more relaxed. There's so many people in Hollywood that must have read a book that in order to become a star, you must first become a snob, and you must first walk around like you're some elite human being because you're on a sitcom. Or you've got a starring role in a film, and they walk with that air about them that I find repugnant. You know,
it doesn't help that the world caters to those people, the celebrities, the actors. The world caters to them, and they basically take it and run with it, become it. Yeah, yeah.
And they, you know, the first time a stand-up comedian starts to go downhill is when they start taking themselves too serious. When you start thinking that every word you say should be chiseled in stone, you know, because you've got an audience that's following you. Anyhow, so I never was, you know, you remember that song in Evita, Don't Cry for Me, Argentina? You know, she says a lyric in there that I never forgot. It's the way I feel about Harvey Illinois. I say to Harvey Illinois, you know, people always say about me that I never forgot where I came from. And I want to say to the people back in Harvey, the truth is I never left you. You know, I never left you. I'm still that little boy with a shoe shine box in his hand, and it's 20 below zero, and I'm on my way to the taverns to shine shoes. I'm in my mind, I'm a heartbeat away from that little boy. That's still who I am in my subconscious mind, you know.
I was going to ask you, as that little boy shining shoes, what did you think you were going to become? What did you see for yourself for the future?
I had no idea. Like most little boys, you dream. I was very athletic, and you think about sports and things like that. But even I couldn't even play Little League Baseball, because in Little League Baseball, the uniforms are free, you had to buy spikes and you had to have a new glove and those kind of things. You know, both my parents were heavy drinkers, and they weren't going to – I wasn't going to get those things. So – I didn't quite know what I wanted to do in life, but when I was growing up, I started thinking I would like to own a tavern one day, because that's where my father spent all of his money. And I thought that, gee, and also the tavern owners, there were 36 taverns in Harvey, Illinois, and there were steel mills and factories everywhere. So these taverns were around them. And the men that owned those taverns, they would say like Ed's Curve Inn and Joe's Dugout and Joe and Murray's Dugout and Bill and Lottie's and Al's Corner Club. They were named after the owner had his name out there on the marquee. It was almost like they were stars. And when you went in the bar, they were behind the bar. And so I used to think that's what I'd like to do one day, own a tavern. And be the bartender, you know, and all that stuff. That's as far as my. Well, you know, what helped me a lot was when I was a little boy, I went to caddy at an all-Jewish country club. And the caddies were all Gentiles like me, Irish, Italian, and stuff like that. But when these members of this club, the members of this club, I got to shut this off, I'm sorry. The members of
this club.
That's okay.
You're wanted. I understand.
The members of this club were all, you know, lawyers and doctors, and they were Mr. Florsheim and people like that. They were very affluent people, and they treated us not like servants. They treated us like sons. And the caddies all got to go to a banquet at the end of the year and, you know, so forth and so on. So it was when I was in that environment and I got out of that tavern environment, all of a sudden I started thinking maybe I could be more than just a tavern owner. You know, because I was now in being touched by lawyers and doctors.
Yes.
That's why
My charity
in Chicago is the Illinois Fathered Initiative. And the reason for that is because I realize how important fathers are in the home and environments are. I understand when the ghetto kid says that he wants to grow up to become a drug pusher or a pimp, because maybe that's the only people he's seen in his neighborhood that are, he sees these men with money in their pockets and driving new cars and rings. He hasn't seen a successful man. So he emulates those kind of people. I was the same way. I was emulating drinkers and people that I wanted to be. And then I got into a different environment, caddying.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got in that environment, and met these men who treated me not like a servant but like a son, I start thinking maybe I could be more, you know. So how important it is, you know.
That's what I was going to say. How, because I know you're from an area, from a city, from a state, but it's all over. It's an epidemic. How do you think that can be rectified, solved? Improved, I guess.
Here's my opinion, and I'm sure that it'll be controversial, but I speak all around the country in churches and stuff like that, and I talk about, but here's my opinion. The reason why my charity in Chicago is the Illinois Fathered Initiative, because they put fatherhood on a high scale, and they, you know, they honor men who are good family men, you know, that. It's no secret that, you know, where I grew up in Harvey in 1960, 4% of the children being born were being born without a father in the home. Today, over 70% are being born without a father in the home. 3 out of every 10 white children in America have no father in the home. 5 out of every 10 Hispanic, no father in the home. And 7 out of every 10 African American, no father in the home. How did that come about? It wasn't that way during World War II, nor was it that way in the 60s. It wasn't that way.
Right.
Where did that come from? You know, first of all, let me digress. 76% of all teenage crimes are committed by fatherless teenagers. You know, how did that change?
Yeah.
Where did that change at? You know, this year, over 70% of the kids being born in Michigan and Detroit are being born without a father in the home. That means we're creating a nation full of criminals. Why did that happen? In 1960, 4%, and then in my hometown, and then today, 70%. I believe it's the war on poverty, well intentioned but misinformed. When they said, "Oh, if you have a baby out of wedlock," then first of all, let me digress again. When I was 13 years old, my mother said to me, "If you get a girl in trouble, you'll stand by her." You know, the mantra was in the African American neighborhood and in the Irish neighborhood, the Italian neighborhood, the Polish neighborhood, the Jewish neighborhood. If a girl gets pregnant, you'll marry her. Now, the kid might say, "I'm not going to marry her." Fine, but you're going to take care of that child. Because if you don't, we have to. It's your responsibility.
Right.
You, the male, are responsible for this. And then the war on poverty came and said, if you have a baby out of wedlock, and I'll make up a figure, we'll give you $250. By the way, if you have two babies out of wedlock with two different men, we get $500. And if you have three babies from three different men, you get $750. And by the way, if the man who impregnates you lives in the same dwelling with you, then you get nothing. So all of a sudden, that what changed this all about was that young men were leaving their responsibilities and allowing the government to become the father of the child. You know, and then it became epidemic. And when it became epidemic, that's when crime in, on the streets. See, where I grew up in Harvey, and I grew up, as you know, I grew up in a predominantly black area because we were so poor. The black men of that community and the men, the white men of the Irish neighborhood and the Italian neighborhood and the Polish neighborhood, if there was a Polish kid roaming the streets in a Polish neighborhood snatching purses and being a thug, the men of that community went out and dragged him and took him home to his father. The same way in the African-American community where I grew up in Harvey, if there was a young kid roaming the streets causing problems, the men of that community took him straight home to his father. The guys in my community were far more afraid of their fathers than they were of the police. So what happens? Now, today, you have all the, you have a grandmother in the south side of Chicago. Not the mother. The grandmother has the four grandchildren. She's trying to keep them away from the gangs. And she's got a broomstick, and the gang's got an AK-47. Who's going to win that fight? It isn't rocket science. That you say, what would I do? I would insist that every politician in America goes in front of the camera to America and says, we apologize. We meant well, but we took away personal responsibility from these young boys. We meant well, but we made a mistake, and we now have to back that up, and we have to get the churches and the people and the government, everybody is talking about personal responsibility. I was back in Harvey, visiting Harvey. As you know, they named a street after me there, and they had a ceremony there. I was back there, and they had a young gang, a street that I sold newspapers on when I was a boy. They had a young gangbanger came up to me and was giving me a bad time. You know, what you doing here? I don't know who you are. I never heard of you. How come they named the street after you? You know, you're supposed to be somebody. And I knew he was baiting me, and I was grinning because that's where I came from. But anyhow, I changed the subject and started talking, and he mentioned something about children. And I said, do you have children? He said, I got four babies, man. I said, well, that's great. He said, from four different women. And I said, oh, okay. I said, do you see your children often? He said, when I want to have sex with their mama. And that was his response to me. In my day, my friends, my black friends' fathers would have grabbed that boy and took him home to their father and said, this is what you raised? Are you kidding me? You know, I mean, again, you it's a long answer to a very short question. Forgive me. But it's time that the government and the people who took this responsibility away has to own up to it. We made a mistake. And let's turn that around, you know. Anyhow, that's my story.
No, I appreciate that. As a motivational speaker, you talk about you being the answer, the person, the who we see in the mirror is the answer. And I think that people know that on some level, but perhaps don't do things to strengthen it consistently. And, of course, life can take us off the path and into lower frequencies and emotions. I know you travel and talk about this and share your wisdom and talk about self-talk and visualization. Tell me the steps or the secret, what I need to do, what my listeners need to do.
Well, I want you to hear this real clear, clear. You know, it's up to you. It's entirely up to you. And this might just be all you ever have to know, that it's up to you. The secret is you are the secret, and it's up to you. You know, all of life is about perception. You know, it's how you perceive it. You know, I make the analogy always. A little boy goes in the backyard with a bat and a ball, and he says, I'm the greatest hitter in the world, and he throws the ball up in the air, and he swings, and he misses. He said, I'm the greatest hitter in the world, and he throws the ball up the second time, and he swings, and he misses. He said, I am the greatest hitter in the world. And he throws the ball up in the third time, and he swings and he misses. He said, I'm the greatest pitcher in the world. Nothing changed but his perception. It was up to him, and he changed the perception. You know, all of us, you know, it's how you perceive life. I tell you this, that I have eight brothers and sisters. You know, we, as you know, we lived in a shack. I repeat myself, but you know, I grew up raggedy poor, holes in my shoes, both parents alcoholic at one time. And I'm here to tell you that's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. That's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. That's the way I perceive it to be. The greatest thing that ever happened to me, because I learned a lot of character, that I learned how to hard work, and that if you work hard, you can become something and accomplish something. You know, so you know that perception of believing that I can make a difference, that I am not a victim, I'm a victor. You know, if any psychiatrist would have heard my story and heard how we were actually raised, you wouldn't believe how we were actually raised in filth and squalor. And both parents alcoholic, he might say, if I ended up in prison, it wasn't his fault, you see. You see, that childhood, it turned him into this poor soul wandering through life. And I say, BS, BS. If it is to be, it's up to me. And I can, and I refuse to let you make a victim out of me. I'm a victor. You know, you've heard me do this in my nightclub act when I talk about, I say to the audience that I was at the University of Illinois giving a motivation speech, and I asked, how long should you live with your parents? I was talking to the students, and one kid said, as long as you want, you could stay with your parents till you're 50 or 60 if you want. And I said, why do you believe that? He said, because we didn't ask to be here. And everybody, you know, applauded it because we didn't ask to be here. And I told them, I don't want to give you a biology lesson, but when the male and the female make love, from the male comes 5 million seeds. Did you know that? 2.5 million die instantly. The other millions die along the way. And soon there's only 100,000 seeds left. Then there's 50,000. Then there's 1,000. Then there's 100. Then there's 5 seeds left. 4, 3, 2, 1, you. Don't ever tell me you didn't ask to be here. BS, you fought to be here. You were born a winner. You know, I said, applaud yourselves. I'm in a room full of winners here. And that's what I want them to know, that you were born a winner. You just have to find that, you know. And the truth is, no matter how hard you work, no matter how good you are, bad things will happen to you. Character is how you deal with those things. You know, none of us go through this life without, you know, stumbling and falling and those problems. If I stumble or fall, I get back up and I keep moving. I see mistakes or failures as nothing more than learning steps along the way to my success. No matter what, I get back up. And that's what I say about perception.
How does self-talk enter
into that equation? Let me get to one other thing, and I hope we're not running out of
time. Oh, yes,
but the other thing I talk about is visualization. Okay, visualization. Whatever the mind can see and believe it will achieve was written thousands of years ago. It's biblical in nature. I read a book years ago called The Power of Your Subconscious Mind by Joseph Murphy, and it really changed my life and how I view things. Nothing can become a reality unless it's thought first. It first has to be thought. You know, Einstein said logic will take you from point A to point B, but imagination will take you anywhere. You know, so when you know that, you know, that what you want, when you, you know, I think it's Buddha who said, all that we are is the result of what we have thought. You know, when I knew that I wanted to be a stand-up comedian, then I would envision myself, I would see myself on the stage that I wanted to be on. I'd see it, feel it, and believe it. Whatever the mind can see and believe it will achieve was written thousands of years ago, like I said. The way you penetrate your subconscious mind, you have two parts of the mind, the conscious and the subconscious. The subconscious mind doesn't know the difference between truth or fiction. It only knows what you program into it. And it works by images. Whatever the mind can see and believe, it will achieve. Now, the conscious mind is loaded with negatives, parents, teachers, people who told you you'll never amount to anything. It's trying to block you from getting into the subconscious mind. Once you rest the conscious mind, the subconscious mind is open to suggestion. That's how they hypnotize you. They put your conscious mind to sleep, and then once your conscious mind is at rest and they tell you hop like a rabbit, you hop like a rabbit because your subconscious mind is open to suggestion. So just before you go to sleep at night and when you first wake up in the morning is when your conscious mind is most at rest. I would see myself on stages that I wanted to be on. On my name on the marquee at Caesar's Palace, on the Tonight Show, talking to Johnny Carson. I saw those things before they became realities, you know, and so whatever the mind can see and believe will achieve. That's what visualization is all about. You know, and the way it works is you say, what was her name? Oh, darn it. What was her name? Oh, darn it. What was her name? What was her name? 2 days later, you say, give me a cup of coffee. Tori Reid. Where did that come from? Once the subconscious mind sees the image you want and the emotion, whatever the mind see and believe it will achieve. It won't rest till it finds a solution. Everything you see in front of you right now at your desk, these are all thoughts before they became realities. The same thing applies to your future. And that's what I say about visualization. As far as self-talk, okay, there was a great book by Shad Helmstetter years ago called, I think it was called What to Say When You Talk to Yourself. You know, the most important person you'll ever talk to is yourself. And a lot of people say, I talk to God. Well, God isn't a person. God's a supreme being. The most important person you'll ever talk to is yourself. What do you say when you talk to yourself? You know, wisdom is avoiding all the thoughts that weaken you. If you don't remember anything I say today, remember this: wisdom is avoiding all the thoughts that weaken you. We know the thoughts that weaken us. You're in a good mood. You're in your car. You're on your way to somewhere, and you're in a good mood, and you're singing along. And moments later, you're feeling sad, and you go, wait a minute, I was just in a good mood. What? And then you trace your thoughts. Oh, yeah, I thought about Larry and that problem I had with him. And the next thing you know, that one thought changed the chemistry of your body.
So,
and through self-talk, always talk good to yourself. Inside all of us is a child, you know, the inner child. There's many books written about that too. One is called The Healing the Child Within You, you know. Talking a little Tori when you say, "Oh, you stupid thing! How dumb can you be? I can't believe I make such dumb mistakes." That little child in you is cowering because you're frightening her, you know. So, you know, what to say when you talk to yourself? You know, the happiness of your life depends on the quality of your thoughts, you know. And you know, what to say when you talk to yourself. You know, keep in mind, think about Harriet Tubman. And I don't have to tell you who Harriet Tubman is. You know, she was, you know, the great facilitator of the Underground Railroad. You know, she said, "I freed 1,000 slaves. I would have freed more if they'd realized that they were slaves." See, in their minds.
Very powerful. Yes.
Yeah. They were slaves, and you that you have to free that from your mind, you know, and what to say when you talk to yourself, you know. The brightest future will always be based on a forgotten past. You can't go forward in life until you let go of your past failures and heartaches. So, you know, you take the negative thoughts and you cast them out and you plant positive thoughts. Think of your brain, your mind, as a garden, and you got a garden and you want to plant beautiful flowers, good thoughts, positive thoughts. You want to plant flowers. And so you plant the flowers, but then weeds grow. Do you allow the weeds to grow?
Yes.
No, you dig the weeds up and replant flowers, you know.
So
positive thoughts are flowers. So what to say when you talk to yourself, you know. I feel, W. Clement Stone used to say, "I feel happy, I feel healthy, I feel terrific." He'd say it 5 times before he went to sleep at night. "I feel happy, I feel healthy, I feel terrific." He lived to be 100 years old, you know.
Wow.
And then also, if you got anything in your past that you regret, and I have many things, make peace with your past so it won't screw up your present. You finally have to make peace with your past. Say, "Okay, I made mistakes. I was young. I was foolish. I forgive you, Tori. I forgive you, Tom. I forgive you for your past mistakes. I know if you could go back and change them, you would, but you can't. So I forgive you." You know, and these are things that, you know, that you bring to pass, you know. By the way, you know, that's the other thing. You know, Henry Ford once said, "Whether you think you can or you can't, you're right." So think you can, you know. And by the way, the other thing, too. The things we fear the most, Tori, think about your past life. When I think back of the things I feared, I used to be afraid of getting an airplane, and then I flew off of aircraft carriers when I was in the service. I wasn't a pilot. I was a crew member. I was a kid, but I was afraid of it. But some most exhilarating things happened was when I was flying off that aircraft carrier, because the thing that I feared, you know, the thing we fear, when you conquer it, I wasn't comfortable going on stage. I was terrified when I first set out. And now it's the greatest joy of my life. So we face our fears head on.
Yes.
And I guarantee you the things you fear the most today are the things that will be the most exhilarating for you in the future, you know.
I love it. I believe it.
Go ahead,
before, because I want you to continue, and I know we have to talk about developing a sense of humor, but before we do that, wanted to say that if anyone has a question or would like to share a comment, call in for some Q&A. The number is 646-668-2928. And I believe someone is holding now that has a question or comment. Are you there? maybe, maybe not. Okay. We'll continue.
We're having
the last point. Yes.
Tori, we're having a little bit of technical
yes.
difficulty, so they'll call back in and notify
for the
you.
Q&A. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, great. Okay. So the last point I want to talk to you about, and as far as importance, was the developing a sense of humor. I know you have done that. You are a master at that. Can you share with me some more?
Well, let's define
talk
a sense of humor. In my humble belief, a sense of humor is not when you have the ability to laugh at other shortcomings and misfortunes. It's when you have the ability
mm-hmm.
to laugh at your own. You know, to be able to laugh at
mm-hmm.
yourself. You will endear yourself to people. Nothing.
Yes.
You know, people that we know of that aren't afraid to poke fun at themselves, you know, and laugh at
mm-hmm.
themselves at the dumb, stupid things that we do sometimes. You know, we like people like that. You know,
yes.
and you will like yourself better.
Sure.
There was a famous actress that I was on the Merv Griffin show with years ago. Her name is Ruth Gordon. She was a brilliant
actress. Oh, I love
actress.
Ruth Gordon.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Wonderful
love
actress.
Her.
I did a
yes.
show with her one time, and Merv Griffin said to her, Ruth, she was like 75 at that time, and she'd been on Broadway for 50-something years. You know, she's just a great
mm-hmm.
and film and everything. And Merv Griffin said, Ruth, I look back at your first appearance on Broadway, and the critics said, and he said, she's not pretty, she doesn't have any stage presence, and Lord knows she can't act. He said, how
wow.
did you survive? How did you survive?
Yes.
And she said, I ignored the facts. Yeah. I love that sense of humor.
That's
I ignored
her.
The facts. Yeah. She was able to laugh at herself, you know. Laughing at a problem, you know.
Yes.
You know, laughing at a problem gives you a feeling of having some power over your troubles. When you can laugh
That's
at a problem,
right.
it decreases in size. You know, so
yes.
so you know, a sense of humor is really the greatest gift that God can bestow upon a human being. You know, and,
yes.
and that's
yes.
being able to laugh at yourself. The happiest people don't have the best of everything. They just make the best of everything. You know, and
right.
so, you know, I think it would be, I think it was the guy, the Charles Schulz, who had the Peanuts, the
mm-hmm.
you know, the cartoon. He
mm-hmm.
said, if I were given the opportunity to present a gift to the next generation, it would be the ability for each individual to learn to laugh at themselves, you know,
mm.
and you yeah. know, it's you know, one of the things you can say to yourself, just say health, healing, wholeness flowing through my life. Laugh at it. Don't grieve at it. What, you know, whatever went in the past that hurt you or something like that, get to a point where
mm-hmm.
you can laugh at it. Don't grieve with it. You know, don't give it the power, you know.
Yes. No, that helps me for sure. Yes. More laughter. Yes. Okay.
And laugh at yourself.
Because okay, I laugh
you know,
a lot.
And by the way, share that with
see,
people,
see, I don't
too.
Do that. I will.
Well, you know what?
Yeah, I don't laugh at myself. I laugh at things. I laugh at movies. I laugh in conversations. And I love to laugh. It's my medicine. But I don't laugh at myself enough, and I need to do that.
Well, you know, and your friends will love you for it. You know, I always say that you can teach children to develop a sense of humor. And the way you do that
mm-hmm.
is when they look at you. You know, children look at the parents and adults, aunts and uncles, like you're gods. Oh, my God. They can't
yes.
envision a world without you because you're in control. Now, when you come in the
yeah.
house, and I would do this. I remember one time I opened a car door, and I smacked myself right in the mouth with the car door, and my mouth was bleeding. Now, I wanted to go in the house and say, somebody threw a rock. We got this darn neighborhood or something like that. But I walked in, and I said, you know what I just did? I just opened the car door and hit myself in the mouth, and my kids thought it was the funniest thing in the world. And you tell them whenever you make a mistake. You know, I was in the store the other day. You know, if you're a woman and I went to reach up for the can of something and I slipped and fell and all the cans fell on top of me and my dress went up over my head and my purse scattered, and you share that with them, they will laugh so hard. But then they're going to tell you later, guess what I did, Mom? I did such and such. Or, you know, and they're going to share their faux pas with you. You know, because it's okay
yes.
to laugh at yourself. You know.
Yes.
A psychiatrist would probably tell you the biggest problem with all their patients is, number one, they take themselves too serious, you know.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, I know self-care is important to you, and I know you do these four things that we're talking about. How are some of the daily, part of your daily routine and daily things that you do to take care of your mind Is it saying mantras? Is it meditating? What do you do, and how do you stay consistent with that?
Yeah, well, it is. It's self-talk. I mean, I have certain things I say to myself every day and every night. And that being said, I'm also, as you know, I am a strong Christian. I really believe in the Lord, and I believe in the heavenly power. And I've called on it so many times in my life. There were so many times I was down, and anybody else, you would think I was out. But then I'd get on my knees, and I'd turn it over. I turned that over. Some nights when it was overwhelming to me, you know. And there was one instance, I'll tell you. After the comedy team, your dad and I split up, I ended up on the West Coast, broke, hitchhiking up and down Sunset Boulevard every night, going to the comedy store, begging to work for free every night. Couldn't even get on at the comedy store. My wife wrote me a Dear John to California and said, I'm sorry that this is your dream, it's not mine. She sent it to a friend's house, and now I'm really destitute. Every day I would go try to find an agent or a manager, somebody to handle me, and one day an agent that was always nice to me threw me out of his office physically. He said, don't come in here anymore, you're bothering me every day. That night I went back to that car that I was sleeping in, this old car, and it wasn't my car, it was up on blocks. And that's how down and out I was. But I was so distraught, but I prayed. I said, God, I can't get anyone to help me with my journey of being a stand-up comedian. No one will take my call. I'm going to turn it over to you. And I know if you call William Morris, they'll take your call. I'm being facetious, but I said, Lord, I turn it over to you. It's now become too much more for me to handle, and I'm tired and I'm exhausted. So I'm going to turn it over to you, and I'm going to know that from this day forward, you're in charge of my career, and you will guide me to the right places. And I slept that night like a baby. It felt like a boulder was off my chest. And within a week, I was on at the comedy store, and one night Carl Reiner saw me and changed my life. Ended up putting me in a film. I took that money and took it to Canada and did some TV shows there. Went back to Chicago, opened for Fats Domino at Mr. Kelly's, where your dad and I used to work all the time. Got my wife to come back with me, bring him back out to the West Coast. And I turned it over. And so that also has always been my faith. Has always been along with, you know. And the other thing, keep away from people who try to belittle your ambitions. Small people always do that. The truly great make you feel that you too can become great. You know, don't hang with people at a certain age. If they're negative, be polite, but move on. Find people that encourage you and that you can encourage back. Get in that atmosphere.
Absolutely. I'm with you on that one. I'm with you on that. I think a call is back on. I think that we're okay with the technical difficulties. Is there someone on?
I believe I might be. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. We can hear you, yes.
Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday.
Hello. Just want to give a shout-out to Celeste Duckworth and Vertical for creating this tremendous platform for authors, emerging authors, and folks inside of the literary world and worlds of entertainment. Then I'd like to give a shout out to Uncle Tom. I hope you'll adopt me as one of your nephews. I've been partnering with Tori, and I really appreciate the work that you've done with her over the decades. She is somebody that is phenomenal, and I feel destined for greatness. I was telling her just this morning that the way I see what she's doing is very analogous to when Phil Donahue used to be on the television years ago, and I know that since you're orientated with the world that came before our world, I saw that Phil Donahue was very gracious in working with an up-and-coming star, Oprah Winfrey, who has since then, you know, in the decades intervening, become all things to all media. But there was an initial seed, and so I saw that Regis Philbin is very familiar with kind of like the old Hollywood game, as it were, and kind of working with inside of that world in a way that's very authentic, genuine, and down to earth. And I was wondering what you saw in terms of your niece, Tori Reid, and where her place will be in the forthcoming years. Because, I mean, you're somebody that's uniquely qualified, having worked with the likes of Frank Sinatra, Liza Minnelli, worked with all of the old Hollywood that created the Hollywood that is now. There is no Felicia Rashad without Cicely Tyson or Lena Horne, and you're familiar with that world. So I just want to know what you perceive as the place that Tori Reid would sit there and occupy in the years coming.
Well, you know, Tori, it's all open to her. But I really believe that Tori had to first suffer somewhat in her life to come to this point. You know, Tori wasn't born, you know, with this point of view she has now. She had some she had some successes and some failures. She strived and she came up short, but she never gave up. And she wanted to find out, how do I get out of this? And what, you know, she didn't just throw in a towel and say, well, I'll just drink myself to death, or I think I'll use drugs and destroy my, you know, my being. She just has never given up. Every time she's had a setback, it was just she'd look it over and then move forward again. And that's what she's got going for her. You know, she wants to know. She was always curious to me. Whenever I would be with her, wouldn't talk but a little bit before she was saying, how do you get from point A to point B? And how did you do that, Uncle Tom? And what do you think about this? And when I would give her, like, a book to read or to say, I read this one, she would go out and get it. You know, she wants to be, you know, and she's willing to study and to sacrifice and to find out and to ask questions, you know, and then to go for it, you know. The other thing too is she's got her dad, of course, is my dear friend, and like she said, he's my brother for the rest of my life. But she also has a mom that is probably the closest thing to Jesus that I ever met in my life. She's just so spiritual and so powerful with her prayers, you know, and all of a sudden. So and she's been praying for Tori since Tori was born, you know, and she's got that support. Yes. When you got that kind of foundation, you know, think of a house that if you have a weak foundation, and you try to build a big, strong house on top of it, it's possibly going to crumble. So sometimes you have the built-in foundation. Sometimes you have to become the foundation of that strong house. You know?
Okay. Nice.
By the way, I met Phil Donahue and Oprah Winfrey, and I did their shows. I did Phil's shows, and I met Oprah so many times. Both of them contributed so much to television, and Oprah especially. Oprah Winfrey, there's nothing that there isn't a subject on the planet that she hasn't attacked and brought it to fold and let people at home know, hey, there's help, and you can overcome this. And she's a classic example.
Well, there's a lot of parallels between you and Oprah in terms of using the power of your mind and also the power of your spirit to be able to create opportunities for other folks. So there's obviously an alignment there. I wanted to tell you in the context of this show that you're doing with Tori, and thank you for coming on as a guest and providing your experiences and your knowledge and your wisdom as a platform. So we formed a company, Victory and Noble, which is a storytelling company focused on book publication, television production, film production, and we're having our rollout event October 12th in La Jolla at the Estancia right across from UC San Diego. And so we've got the first part of the show, which is a symposium that will be focused on book-to-film adaptation, diversity through profitability, and then memoirs, legacy. That's the first part of the day. But in the latter part of the evening, we're having a gala event, which will focus on the contribution of outstanding figures to American and world culture. And so one of the awards we're giving out will be named in honor of our godmother, Nikki Giovanni, who will be giving out the Lifetime Legacy Achievement Award in literature and culture. And then the second award that we're giving out for Mr. Tim Reed, who's been doing some tremendous work in Africa. We're right now in the process of connecting between the governments of Addis Ababa, Dr. Abiy Ahmed, the new prime minister there, who's undertaking democratic reforms, and then also the mayor's office. We would love to have you on board as part of our advisory committee for that undertaking. So we'd love to set up some time in the forthcoming weeks to be able to talk with you, introduce myself to you, and then also talk a little bit about Mr. Reed, his contributions as you know it, and be able to have you on that steering committee.
What do you have the date of that in October?
Yes,
October 12th.
Yes,
October 12th. That's a Saturday, yeah. Right now, that date, I'm looking at my calendar as I speak, right now, that date, I'm supposed to be on October 12th, a thing called that I've committed to called Taste of Italy. It's something, you know, because I'm half Italian, but we'll talk about, I would like to talk to you more, anything I can do to give you some insight to the Tim Reed I know, you know. And well, if he's actually, listening to the show, he just cringed.
He's actually listening and holding to. He has a question or comment for you.
Oh my!
Yes, he's actually on.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'd be glad to help you. If you want me to consult with me, Tori has my numbers. Please feel free to call me anytime, and I'll be
yes,
glad
sir.
To
yes, sir. Yes, I'll exit out of the queue and just thank you again.
Thank
and
you.
It's a pleasure meeting you.
My pleasure.
Hello?
I hear noise.
Hello? Can you hear my voice?
Are we on
can
opinion?
We can hear your
Hello, you're on opinion.
No. Can you hear me? I've been trying to get in for an hour with the two of you talking. I'll be landing in Italy before you finish.
Your father is so polite, Tori. He just called us both a couple of blabbermouths, but no one would know that.
Well, the show is sounding good. I'll give you that much. The show is sounding good. You're saying some wonderful things. And I just want to say continued success. And you owe me money, I think, don't you? Don't you owe me some money from 74 or something?
I do. I know I owe you a coat. Your father, Tori, you don't know this, but one time in the winter, I mean, I was raggedy. Just raggedy, and your dad was always dressed so well, you know. And one winter, I actually did not have a winter coat in Chicago, and he gave me one of his coats, which was a real nice coat. And in fact, I still have it to this day, you know. I'm going to put it up on eBay in a little while.
and this,
well, I had to
everyone
keep you healthy.
Listening
had,
is Tim Reed. Tim Reed was
I told him I had to keep him healthy. Without him, I was already starving. I would have starved worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Your daddy and I had a wonderful, wonderful experience. The 6 years that we toured together, you know, for your listeners who do not know, I mean, you know, we toured the North and the South. We worked all black nightclubs in the North and the South, and same way, all white clubs. The Playboy circuits. We, you know, there were no comedy clubs in America in those days, so we worked nightclubs and had great experience, a lot of fun, a lot of good times, and we had some tough times, but like we talked about here, we overcame that and continued on. And as I say all the time, the world was not ready for your dad and I, but we were ready for each other. And that all the things that the world might have done, or the business we're in, to break up the team, they never broke up our friendship, nor will they, could they ever. And it's stronger today than ever. And that's really what it's all about. I forgot where I heard this quote, but it says, there's a destiny that makes us brothers. No one goes his way alone. All that we send into the hearts of others comes back into our own. And I think that pretty much sums up your dad and I.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
You've gotten more elegant. He's gotten more elegant in his older life. quoting poetry. My goodness, I'm impressed.
Wait to hear this. Roses are red, violets are blue. Not a one for you.
Well, I'm not going to be able to stay long. I'm actually sitting on the plane waiting for him to shut the door. I'm on my way from Austin, Texas, to Atlanta, and then hopefully. Ultimately to Richmond, but we'll see how the flight goes. You know, we got a delay already, but that's flying.
Well, thank you for joining us, Tim, and if you're expecting a check from this, just keep expecting.
Well, it's a pleasure hearing you. I happened to do her show last weekend. It was so much fun. It was the first time she had interviewed me, and it's really just timely and wonderful that she was able to interview you as well right after, because we help her get a good start going. It's a good show. You guys, just listening what I've been able to listen with you and Tom, and you're saying some wonderful things people need to hear.
Oh, thank you.
Travel
thank
safe,
you,
my
Dad.
Brother, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. All right. Love you both.
Love you.
Yeah, love you too, Dad. Oh, no, I don't call him
Dad. Don't take it too far. Don't take it too far. Bye now.
Bye. So, Uncle Tom, I know you mentioned the book that you all did with Ron Rappaport and that you're presently trying to adapt that into a film. What else are you working on currently? If you want to share more about that, any movement with that, or any dream projects in the work that you're that you're working on?
Well, I'm writing my own book now that'll probably,
for
lack
that.
Of a better term, I'm almost finished with it, to be honest with you. And it'll be
gosh,
out.
Oh, my gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah. Post Hill Press is producing it, publishing it, and Simon & Schuster will distribute it. And it's it'll be out before Father's Day next year. And I'm just about finished with it. I think I might call it, I'm thinking of a title, but it'll probably be called Still Standing After All These Years. You know, and because it has a double entendre, I'm a stand-up comedian,
yes.
but I've been knocked down a lot in my life, but I keep getting back up. So I'm still standing after.
Oh, love that.
I think that's what I'll call the book. But I'm doing that, and then I'm doing my one-man show, An Evening
yes,
of Laughter, and Memories of Sinatra. It's on my website, tomdreesen.com, if anybody wants to go to it. Again, it's DREESEN, so there's three E's in there. Most people put a couple S's, but it's DREESEN.com. And it'll always have where I'm appearing at next, you know. I love stand-up
nice.
Comedy, and I love doing it. And my one-man show is a 90-minute show of stand-up comedy and storytelling. And then I have pictures that authenticate the stories that I'm telling. And there's I in there tell the story of your dad and I, as well as me touring with Sammy and working with Dean Martin and doing the the Frank Sinatra tour. It's just a lot of fun. The whole I'm still having a lot of fun performing. I love you know, you come to the Laugh Factory and you see me get up on weekends sometimes.
Oh, yes.
And I enjoy that so much. I was there again last night trying out new material. It was so much fun.
Oh, wonderful. Do you have a future date?
April 17th. No, I'm sorry. This month, August 17th, I'm in Valparaiso, Indiana, in about 2 weeks doing my one-man show, an evening at the Memorial Opera House. And I'm doing that. And then I've got other dates in September. I've got it all on my website, you know.
Okay. All right. Well, that's wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. We've got to have dinner soon. Please. Have to do it. I've got to hear more about this.
Okay.
thank you. Thank you so much for joining me, Uncle Tom, and sharing your light and energy and inspiration with me. And this has just been a joy for me to do this with you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's kind of surreal to me as well, because I remember the little baby in the crib, and now this little baby in the crib is interviewing me. This is kind of surreal.
I love it. I love it. Thank you to my listeners. I hope you enjoyed yourselves and will join me again on another episode of Simply Tori. Join me in 2 weeks, actually, Sunday, August 18th, and I'm going to keep the inspiration and brilliant conversations coming to you. Until then, be light, stay motivated, and don't let your thoughts weaken you.